liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
When you attend a funeral, it is sad to think that sooner or later those you love will do the same for you. And you may have thought it tragic, not to mention other adjectives, to think of all the weeping they will do. But don't you worry, no more ashes, no more sackcloth, and an armband made of black cloth will someday nevermore adorn a sleeve. For if the bomb that drops on you gets your friends and neighbors too, there'll be nobody left behind to grieve, and we will all go together when we go. What a comforting fact that is to know. Universal bereavement, an inspiring achievement. Yes, we all will go together when we go. We will all go together when we go, all suffused with an incandescent glow. No one will have the endurance to collect on his insurance. Lloyd's of London will be loaded when they go. We will all fry together when we fry. We'll be French fried potatoes by and by. There will be no more misery when the world is our rotisserie. Yes, we all will fry together when we fry. We will all bake together when we bake. There'll be nobody present at the wake. With complete participation in that grand incineration, nearly 3 billion hunks of well-done steak. We will all char together when we char, and let there be no moaning of the bar. Just sing out a te deum when you see that ICBM, and the party will be come as you are.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Raw Deal. I have a wonderful guest today who's tied up and will join us at her earliest opportunity. In the meanwhile, I want to, turn down the volume. I'm not getting any feedback myself, so today's kind of unusual. Okay. I want to report some major developments on the vaccination front, including that it turns out that 100% of the COVID-19 vaccine deaths have been caused by only 5% of the batches produced, according to official government data. Now, if you go to my blog at jamesfetzer.org, you can read the entire article, but the key feature is the following. An investigation of data found in the USA's vaccine adverse event reporting system has revealed that extremely high numbers of adverse reactions and deaths have been reported against specific lot numbers of the COVID-19 vaccine several times, meaning deadly batches of the experimental injections have now been identified. What's perhaps even more concerning is that the deadly lots were distributed widely across the United States, while the other benign lots were sent to just a few locations. I wonder whether, therefore, they used the benign to subject the testing so CDC could claim they were safe and effective while the lethal doses were being distributed all over the country. Now, Dr. Michael Yerdon, a former vice president and vaccine expert at Pfizer, has discussed this article on Telegram. Here's what Yerdon, who's a good guy, once a monster, now a good guy, has to say. This information about different safety profiles of different lots, batches of finished product of COVID-19 vaccines, is completely without precedent. I'm thinking about it. and I don't yet have clear in my mind what the envelope of plausible possible explanations are. But the bottom line is that the majority of lots were associated with good short-term safety, few hospitalizations and death, true both for Pfizer and for Moderna. But in both cases, a small number of vaccine lots are associated with incredibly high rates of adverse effects, including deaths. How can this possibly happen? Drug manufacturing is performed to exacting standards of control. The active agent is made in batches. It cannot be guessed how many doses each batch makes because no one has ever made commercial-scale mRNA products before. But each batch of what's called drug substance is then used to formulate, fill, pack, and label various lots of finished drug product. Testing methods are developed for all of the manufacturing steps together with standards for the results to be considered acceptable. Something happened between drug substance and drug product, which resulted in a small number of finished lots for distribution, which were destined to kill huge numbers of people. Possible explanations, not exhaustive. First, errors made in the final steps of manufacturing, which resulted in certain batches being reasonably benign and others extraordinarily deadly. I just cannot imagine the kind of mistakes that would produce such radically different clinical profiles. For example, poor handling during shipping and storage prior to administration to people. Problem I have with this is that such handling errors, for example, allowing temperature to rise way above limits defined in stability testing, usually result in drug product which doesn't work properly as it's degraded, not in drug product that's incredibly dangerous. Second alternative explanation. At some point in manufacturing, someone or some entity actively modified what was being filled into the vials, and it was this which resulted in the extreme skew of the clinical safety profile. There has been so much truly awful behavior of elites that I'm simply not willing, as I would have historically, meaning in the past, to dismiss the possibility that this has been done on purpose. What I do know, this is a test of whether there's the slightest sign of integrity from these companies as well as the regulatory agencies, is that all use of the effective product must be immediately ceased. All batches of drug substance and lots of drug products should end. The materials should be recalled to a place of stable storage and an intense analytical investigation initiated. Unless factors are found which adequately explain the huge difference in clinical adverse event profiles, administration to humans must not restart. Just when you thought the debacle couldn't possibly get any worse, it gets much worse. Expect to hear much more about this. Meanwhile, who in their right mind would roll up their sleeve? Note, I have no information on other vaccines or other territories not covered by this analysis of Avers. Best wishes, Mike, Dr. Mike Yearden. This guy is 100% a good guy. And there are extensive graphs that accompany this. So if you want to check it out, please go to my blog at jamesfetcher.org and take a look. Something very, very strange is taking place here. And personally, I think this confirms that the political character of what's taking place. In fact, I can't imagine what would be a definitive indication that we have been played and that these different lots have such stunningly different consequences and effects on their recipients. This is totally outrageous, in my opinion, just completely stunning. Meanwhile, the Biden administration is considering giving $450,000 per person to immigrants separated at the border. This is incredible. There are still 1,727 children who've not been reunited with their families since being separated under the Trump administration's zero tolerance policy. Story at a glance. The federal government could give immigrant families separated at the U.S. border close to $1 million. Discussions are ongoing and would be part of a settlement package for multiple lawsuits the federal government is facing. The Office of Inspector General previously found the Trump administration Department of Justice unprepared to manage and implement its zero tolerance policy. Well, let me just say, this whole policy of separation was introduced by Bill Clinton, not by Donald Trump. It was enforced by Barack Obama. You may recall when we had the situation where, in their ongoing efforts to trash Trump, they showed photographs of children in cages, and where it turned out that the photographs had been taken during the Obama administration because they were doing that themselves. This wasn't a Trump problem. Continuing the story, the Biden administration could pay out up to $1 billion to immigrant families that were separated at the U.S.-Mexico border during the Trump administration. According to the Wall Street Journal, the Departments of Justice, Homeland Security, and Health and Human Services could end up paying out close to $1 million per immigrant family separated at the border. Sources told the Journal that around $450,000 a person is being considered, but that figure could change depending on each family's circumstances. Discussions of payouts have taken place over the course of the past few months between lawyers representing immigrant families who are suing the federal government and the government's own lawyers, according to the Journal. Some government lawyers apparently viewed the payout amounts as excessive, as do I. In fact, I think any normal Americans are going to find this completely outrageous and insulting. I mean, this is taxpayer money, once again, where the Biden administration is giving a red carpet rollout to these illegal immigrants, getting them across the border effortlessly, not requiring them to be vaxxed, even flying them in the dead of night around the country, putting them on the dole. Many have been put up in hotels. And I'll bet that includes room service at taxpayer expense. If there's ever been a more disgusting administration in the history of the United States, I'd like to know what that would have been. This is just grotesque beyond words. Margo Schlanger, a Homeland Security officer for civil rights and civil liberties during the Obama administration, told the Journal, damage class actions of this in this kind of a case are pretty rare. It's hard to think of a recent comparison. The ACLU is representing multiple families in a lawsuit over the Trump administration's zero tolerance policy, and in January issued a statement urging the incoming Biden administration to act quickly on the issue. The incoming administration must reunite the separated families in the United States, but we cannot stop there. These families deserve citizenship, resources, care, and a commitment that family separation will never happen again. The Biden administration created the Interagency Task Force on the Reunification of Families, and its latest progress report, released in September, confirmed it had reunited 50 children separated from their parents and provided access to behavioral health services. Another 2,171 have been reunified through a court order and from the efforts of governmental organizations. However, the same report confirmed 1,727 have not yet been reunified with their families, accounting for 33% of all those identified as separated from their parents by the Homeland Security Department under the Trump administration's zero tolerance policy. That is, to me, absolutely stunning. Stunning. And remember, this open borders policy, and have no doubt about it, this is the Biden administration's effort to contribute to one world government by completely eviscerating our borders. I mean, that's what they're doing. They have imposed all kinds of constraints on ICE officers, They've taken away their horses. They've restricted where they can arrest. They've created all these sanctuary areas where ICE isn't allowed to enforce. Mind you, the integrity of a nation cannot be preserved or maintained with open borders. What could be more obvious? What could be more obvious? Now, it's very interesting that down in Texas, the governor has done something, in my opinion, quite brilliant by creating a barrier out of shipping containers, those gigantic shipping containers. Let me pull it up. I mean, this is just absolutely fascinating that Governor Abbott has done this, putting them up. Notice, I mean, it's cheaper, faster. I would suggest even more effective, because those containers are so massive that no one's going to imagine they could work their way around them. The border fence, by comparison, which costs quite a lot of money, right? Billions of dollars. I mean, these shipping containers, putting them in place, I mean, they already exist. It's a brilliant idea. I think someone gave Abbott the right idea. Here we go. As a nation faces a border crisis and shipping crisis, Texas Governor Greg Abbott decided to take on both issues at once. The state is now using empty shipping containers to strategically block key border crossings to better defend the Lone Star State from a flood of illegal immigrants. The National Guard has already been using razor wire, according to Abbott's interview on Fox this week. We now have 6,500 National Guard and DPS troopers on the border to help secure the border. And as we're talking right now, they are identifying locations on the border where they're laying down razor wire to secure all the possible crossings these caravans may be coming to. But the container idea is new. Instead of a port filled with containers it can't hold, Abbott is redirecting excess containers to build a blockade of his own. And then in addition to that, beginning today, we begin dropping these large containers that you see on 18-wheelers that you also see on these ships that are going across the ocean. We're dropping them down on locations that could be crossings that would be used by these caravans to serve as a blockade to prevent them from coming across the border. The governor seems serious about stepping up against Biden's open border crisis. Instead of an open door, Abbott has razor wire, a blockade, National Guard members, and claims the state will arrest illegal immigrants for criminal trespass in Texas, all of which I applaud. Texas tried earlier in the year with limited success. After quickly arresting a few thousand illegal immigrants, it had to release them as lawsuits pushed back on holding people for more than 30 days without due process. Overcrowding will become an almost immediate issue as well. About 192,000 illegal immigrants entered America last month alone. All the prisons based in Texas couldn't hold that number. But at least Texas is making an effort. The border has always been a challenge, but Biden has turned the challenge into a catastrophe by overturning Trump's policies and opening the door to whoever wants to show up. Since Texas has the longest border to patrol, it makes sense they would try to do something. California isn't going to help. Arizona is making some impact. New Mexico has been largely quiet as a crossing route. However, the next conflict to take place will soon be whether the Biden administration will choose migrants over Texans. Let me give you a clue. They will. Will Biden sit back and let Abbott and friends operate freely, or will he choose to intervene and make things even worse if that's possible? We're about to find out, as a massive caravan of at least 4,000 are currently walking through Mexico toward Texas. When they arrive, we may see a showdown between Texas National Guard and migrants. with a nation watching the scene unfold and Abbott standing as the last line of defense for America. I applaud Governor Abbott. By the way, these people aren't walking through Texas. They're being transported by caravans, They're being brought here, and I have footage of the caravans, and on the caravans, they have the Star of David. This is an Israeli op. Yes. I got an attempt to phone call here, but no answer, probably because they could tell I was on the air. Meanwhile, here's another, and let me elaborate, by the way. There's no doubt whatsoever that the open borders policy is the North American equivalent of the flooding of Western Europe by Africans, okay? There's just no doubt about it, that this is the Kalergi plan, which is to destroy Western culture by a flood of migrants. And I believe the Democrats have latched on to it because they did so terribly in the last election. They're trying to create a new class of Democrat voters. And it becomes, I think, equally apparent that this is an Israeli operation. It's part and parcel of the attempt to destroy America, where George Soros himself said that it was his life's ambition to destroy America before he dies, and where Soros has expended a vast amount of his fortune on the corrupting the U.S. judicial surface by supporting candidates for district attorney who will not apply the law equitably to Americans. This is simply outrageous. And, I am stunned that we have this continuing situation. So, and I got to say, you know, that we have numerous technical issues today that are fascinating too, but we'll just deal with. We have a development with respect to 5G, where it turns out that 5G appears to be running interference with the cockpits in airplanes and could interfere and cause planes to crash. How's that for a benefit of 5G? The U.S. Federal Aviation Administration is sounding alarms behind closed doors over plans to use a new spectrum 5G for networks, citing deep concern the towers could interfere with aircraft systems, according to multiple reports. With network carriers set to start using the C-band spectrum for 5G before the end of the year, the FAA has raised deep concern about the potential impact to aviation safety from the technology and intends to issue a public warning, according to an agency letter obtained by Reuters on Friday. Written by FAA Deputy Administrator Bradley Mims and dated October 6th, the document questions whether 5G operations in the C-band spectrum could potentially cause interference to radar altimeter performance, referring to a key cockpit safety system which measures a distance between an aircraft and the ground. Nice to know how far a plane is above the ground, but 5G might disrupt it. The aviation regulator is drafting a special bulletin and a number of mandates pertaining to the use of 5G in the C-band, according to unnamed officials and industry sources cited by Reuters and the Wall Street Journal, although it's unclear if it intends to release the warning or when the new rules would take effect. Even NATO countries, by the way, listen to this, complained as planned Russian 5G testing near St. Petersburg could interfere with military aircraft systems. Well, think about it. Even NATO is concerned about it. This might be a major reason for opposing 5G if it's going to cause commercial and military planes to fall out of the sky. I mean, this is outrageous. used in all commercial airliners, radar altimeters can help to avert crashes and mid-air collisions, as well as assist with landings during inclement weather, among other things. However, the FAA and some industry experts fear that the new 5G signals transmitted from ground-based wireless towers could throw off the instrument's readings enough to cause certain flight control systems to malfunction. Despite the dire warnings from the FAA, the Federal Communication Commission does not share the same concerns. After a review last year, the agency, which regulates the airwaves, concluded the use of 5G in the C-band would have no harmful effect on well-designed aviation equipment, notice that qualification, freeing the way for cell providers to start using the spectrum. I think this is a case where the Federal Communications Commission is just as negligent as the CDC has been negligent, the FCC in relation to air ground communications and the risk of flight crashes, the CDC regarding the threats of these vaccines, which we're now finding has what appears to be a very clear political agenda, which was always obvious from the beginning. But now we have objective evidence in the form of the distribution of lots, and that some are deadly while others are relatively benign. The FCC remains committed to safety while moving forward with the deployment of new technologies that support American business and consumer needs, a spokeswoman told Reuters. The telecom industry has also pushed back on the safety concerns, right? What if a few planes crash? In a statement to the journal, the CTIA, which represents industry giants such as AT&T, T-Mobile, and Verizon, argued any delay in activating the spectrum is going to affect America's competitiveness and jeopardize their ability to ensure global 5G leadership. What bullshit. What unadulterated bullshit. We'll be right back.
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Aha.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
No sound.
Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslip.com, the People Station.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
I don't know Joe Rogan, but he has confirmed that his doctor treated over 200 members of Congress with ivermectin. Remember, we're not supposed to get ivermectin. We're not allowed to use it. But over 200 members of Congress have been treated with ivermectin, as Joe Rogan reports, because his doctor was the one who performed the service for the Congress. I mean, good God, what is going on here? Meanwhile, Biden is back down on his December 8th vaccine deadline. The Biden administration's COVID-19 vaccination deadline will not require immediate action on the part of employers against unvaccinated employees when it comes into force on December 8th, the White House coronavirus response coordinator said on Wednesday. Some lawyers previously interpreted Biden's September 9th executive order and subsequent White House guidance requiring all federal employees to be vaccinated by December 8th as a mandate unless they got a religious or medical exemption. The White House comments suggest federal contractors employing millions of U.S. workers have significant flexibility in enforcing COVID rules and will not be required to immediately lay off workers, but will have time for education, counseling, and other measures before potentially ending employment. I have friends, correspondents, who actually took the jab because they felt they were being pressured to do so by their employers. And here it all turns out to be bullshit. But I've been saying that from the beginning. It's not legal. It's a clear violation of the Nuremberg Code that to mandate these vaccinations, an experimental medical procedure, and making it involuntary, making it coerced, is completely outrageous, and yet it proceeds apace. Jeff Zients said he expects federal agencies and contractors will follow their standard HR processes, and that for any of the probably relatively small percentage of employees who are not in compliance, they'll go through education, counseling, accommodation, and then enforcement, meaning they're going to try to brainwash you before they fire you. He said he doesn't expect any disruption in the U.S. economy as a result of the mandate. Right, right, right. Good God, how dumb are we supposed to be? We're creating flexibility within the system. There's not a cliff here. Wow. he said, emphasizing the goal is to get people vaccinated, not to punish them, so we do not expect any disruptions, he added. These processes play out across weeks, not days. His comments were more explicit than those of last week. He also said a new emergency measure will soon be finalized to ensure private sector workers at companies with 100 or more employees are fully vaccinated or tested at least weekly. American and Southwest Airlines said last Thursday they did not think the December 8th deadline would impact holiday travels or result in employees leaving. Some airlines and industry watchers initially feared an exodus as unvaccinated airline or government employees involved in travel just before Christmas. Southwest Airlines Chief Executive Gary Kelly said last week, "We want our employees to know that nobody is going to lose their job on December 9th if we're not perfectly in compliance. We're not going to fire anybody who doesn't get vaccinated," contradicting, of course, what he had said previously. American Airlines Chief Executive Doug Parker said last week he did not expect any employees to leave as a result of the vaccine mandate. A group representing FedEx, United Parcel, and other cargo carriers told the White House it would be virtually impossible to have 100% of the respective workforces vaccinated by December 8th. Many federal contractors have told employees they risk losing their jobs if they're not vaccinated by December 8th. Raytheon Technologies Chief Executive Greg Haynes, for example, warned in a CNBC interview on Tuesday, the U.S. aerospace and defense firm will lose several thousand employees who refuse to take the vaccines and prepares to meet the December 8th deadline. Republican Senator Roger Wicker Wednesday urged Biden to abandon the plan, saying, "We cannot afford to gut our transportation network of tens and perhaps hundreds of thousands of essential, good-paying jobs." I have no doubt that is happening. It's moving forward very aggressively. Now, all this calamity taking place by the Biden administration is having political ramifications. For example, yesterday on Meet the Press, October 31st, Halloween, this is a very scary event here. NBC's Chuck Todd was forced to reveal the latest Biden polling. It's bad, really bad. MSNBC's Chuck Todd was forced to reveal the latest polling about how Americans are feeling about Joe Biden. "This is scary news for the Democrats," he said. "The overarching message, Americans have lost their confidence in President Biden and their optimism for the country." Here's a RNC tweet. "Watch MSNBC Chuck Todd highlight the new polling that's filled with some scary news for the Democrats." And Chuck Todd, by the way, I've long observed, clearly has a liberal bias. He clearly has a liberal bias. And he's put up front and center on both NBC and MSNBC. Listen to this. Some of the results. Which party would do a better job? Border security. Republicans by 27%. Inflation. Republicans by 24%. Crime. Republicans by 22%. National security. Republicans by 21%. Economy. Republicans by 18%. Getting things done. Republicans by 13%. It must have pained Chuck Todd to have to report this, but Americans are suffering under this administration and the numbers are starting to reflect it. Meanwhile, with a country in crisis, Biden and a third of his cabinet are halfway around the world talking about climate change. And by the way, it appears to me that if the vaccine agenda falters, and I believe it's very likely to falter at this point with all the studies and evidence emerging, including the over 2 million adverse effects that are recorded by the World Health Organization, 70% of which were impacting women, in my opinion, a clear indication of the anti-fertility or reproduction, that this is not only to stem the birth rate, but to accelerate the death rate, where we've discovered, you know, the deadly pattern here across the nation, and where the 2 million is 1,000 times more than the year before, which was only 2,000, which was thousands of times more than the year before at only about 87, and before that, 2 and 1. In other words, what's going on now is more adverse effects than those cumulatively from all vaccinations that have been used in the past altogether, altogether. This is absolutely horrific. So even Chuck Todd is having to admit this polling for Democrats is scary. The Republicans couldn't be better situated for 2022 and 2024. The flailing Biden administration just can't stop messing up. From the botched Afghanistan withdrawal to COVID vaccine mandates to a general lack of leadership, Americans desperately want out of the mess. A red wave is almost certain. Therefore, the real issue for Republicans is not getting elected, which they will, thanks to the Democrats' constant blundering, but translating electoral success into legislative wins. That means fully securing the border, fixing our broken immigration system, and getting the conservative agenda cemented into law. But there's a huge caveat that goes along with that. If we're still using Dominion voting machines, which were designed to steal elections, why should we expect the midterm of 2020 will be any different in its outcome than the presidential for 2022 than the presidential for 2020? The Democrats have no choice. They're going to lose every election unless they steal them. And believe me, they're adept at stealing them. They are going to do it again and again and again. Meanwhile, we have an election tomorrow in Virginia for governor, and there are stunning developments taking place there. Let me give you a brief update and then return to what's going on here. A Fox News poll from Thursday showed that Terry McAuliffe, who was leading just weeks before, 51-46, is now fallen behind by 8 points. Glenn Youngkin leads him 53-45. The explanation appears to be multiple in his variations, that McAuliffe has really pissed off parents because he's denied that their critical race theory is being taught in the Virginia schools and is certain that they have no role in relation to the school boards, and that the parents basically should just sit down and shut up. And where 2 rapes that occurred in girls' rooms by a transgender, one I know is a 15-year-old girl, and they hushed it up, and they transferred this transgender to another school, and he did it again, has the cauldron boiling in Virginia. The parents are seething over this. And then McAuliffe pulled a stupid stunt by trying to play on Charlottesville, where he had been himself instrumental, about which I will say a fair number of words. But here, he goes on. So, you know, on Meet the Press, right? They want to give him a break. They want to give Terry McAuliffe an opportunity to respond to Youngkin. And what does he do? He goes on there and digs the hole deeper. I mean, he blunders again. Listen to this. Terry McAuliffe just dug a deeper hole for himself. During an interview Sunday morning on Meet the Press, he attacked parents again. The video clips expose McAuliffe as a desperate politician who is his own worst enemy because of his stubbornness. McAuliffe wrongly blames Glenn Youngkin for stirring parents up and creating a ruckus at school board meetings. During the interview, he claimed everyone clapped when he said parents shouldn't control education. This is the very reason McAuliffe could lose the election. Contrary to what McAuliffe claims, everyone in Virginia isn't clapping and agreeing with McAuliffe about excluding parents from involvement in educating their children. This is a case of believing your own propaganda. I mean, they bring in a bunch of stooges, no doubt most of whom are staff members. Others are devoted supporters of Terry McAuliffe. And when he makes his statement, they clap. But the rest of the state is just deploring his conduct. This is so outrageous. This is so disgusting. This guy grossly deserves to be taken out of office. McAuliffe offends parents in the third clip below by calling them racist and falsely claims Virginia schools don't teach critical race theory. Our school boards were fine. These people started showing up, creating such a ruckus. Everyone clapped when I said parents should not control education. McAuliffe again falsely claims CRT is not taught while smearing concerned parents as racist. These are self-inflicted wounds due to the stubbornness of McAuliffe. So, finding himself in a bind, what's he going to do? He's going to try to trash Youngkin and make Youngkin out to be a racist. Remember, for the Democrats, everything is racism, 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 racism. There's no end to it. So, they had they created a little stunt. They had five individuals dressed in long-sleeved white shirts, khaki trousers, and caps. They weren't all uniform. Out in front of a Youngkin bus in Charlottesville and holding tiki torches. I mean, this is just ridiculous. Anyone who thinks about it remembers on the Friday before the fiasco in Charlottesville, there's a tiki torch lit campaign onto the campus of the University of Virginia. So the tiki torches are supposed to tie in with what was supposed to have been a racist assault when it was really completely different. What you had was a group of peaceful protesters who even had a permit who were protesting the removal of the statue of Robert E. Lee, a magnificent statue, by the way, where all these statues were part and parcel of the reconciliation between the North and the South. Respecting and recognizing the leadership on both sides as sincere patriotic Americans who simply had differences on the issue of whether the states had the right to secede from the Union over which the war was technically fought, and the institution, the abolition or not of the institution of slavery, which is popularly presented as the key issue, but in fact, technically, it was whether the states had the right to secede from the Union, which the Civil War resolved in the negative. They do not, which is another reason why I'm concerned with a lot of talk about states dividing, California dividing, Virginia dividing, all this other stuff, seceding from the Union. As I understand it, there's one and only one state that actually would have the legal entitlement to do that, which is Texas. Texas had been an independent state, an independent nation, as it were, before it joined the Union and did so under particular provisions that make it distinctive. To my understanding, Texas alone would have the right to secede from the Union should it choose to do so. Now, the reasons for not seceding are just enormous and varied. E pluribus union, one out of many. You have a stronger, vigorous America when you have the 50 states contributing to the success of the nation. I mean, there are all kinds of activities, the financial resources, the armed forces, interstate transportation, and so forth, that make a strong, vital America that's been responsible for our huge success in the past, where the succession of various parts, the balkanization of the United States would destroy all of that, make it a collection of very weak, little, tiny statelets, as it were, or nations, as opposed to the mammoth unified United States. In spite of all our divisions, I do not believe secession in any way, shape, or form represents a future. I mean, after all, What's going to happen if these states secede? What, are they going to have their own army and their own navy? I mean, give me a break. This is ludicrous. Yeah, but I have dear friends whose opinions I respect completely who think that it's a good idea. Well, I stand in opposition. I think it's a very bad idea, but it's another way that would bring about the end of the United States. So if the globalists want to bring about the end of the United States, well, they seem to have launched a completely effective, well-thought-out plan using the COVID and the vaccine to either kill us or divide us, to weaken the military. Because, you know, if you vax the military, and of course they're going to have the bad lots to vax the military, then you're going to, those who leave will, yes, be healthy and strong, but they won't be part of the military, while those who stay are going to be vaccinated and be either tremendously compromised physically or die. And we continue to have report after report of physically vigorous people who take the vax, and that's the end of it. That's their song and dance. So all this is catastrophic. The nation has to find a way to sort this out. And frankly, the solution is not at all obvious. Let me give you a further report here about the Nazis supposedly reporting Republican candidate with tiki torches revealed to be a false flag stunt. Here it's attributed to the Lincoln Project, but I guarantee you this was not the Lincoln Project. The Lincoln Project was only brought in to be the sop to play the role of responsibility when it's clearly the McAuliffe campaign, for reasons that become very, very obvious when you take a closer look. With the Virginia gubernatorial campaign down to the wire, Democrats pointed and shrieked at Nazis allegedly supporting their opponent in Charlottesville. The Lincoln Project that admitted to the false flag stunt, but I tell you, I guarantee you, that's a sop. That's false. They didn't do it. They had nothing to do with it. The election has gone from a sure thing for Democrat Terry McAuliffe to a possible upset by Republican Glenn Youngkin in recent weeks. On Friday, as Youngkin came to Charlottesville for the final campaign push, reporters were drawn to a group of people posing in front of his bus in pouring rain. All five wore hats, sunglasses, white shirts, khaki, and tiki torches in what seemed to be a reference to the 2017 Unite the Right rally that ended in violence. Let me just add, what McAuliffe, who was then governor, did was to have the Democrat mayor have the Charlottesville police stand down, and I have no doubt the mayor was part and parcel of this too, so that McAuliffe could have the Virginia State Police channel the peaceful protesters into a violent confrontation with Black Lives Matter and Antifa members who'd been bussed in, many on the same bus, by George Soros. So it was a staged manufactured event. And then I'll return to this further. There was then the second episode, the follow-up, making this, as it were, a 1-2-3 punch with a torchlit parade the night before. But then this completely contrived violent interaction that was manufactured by the governor, Terry McAuliffe, in my opinion, was a brainchild behind this whole contrived, but no doubt he had experts from Hollywood aiding and abetting, as they're doing the Democrats all over the country. And then we had the alleged crash of a car into the crowd. I'll go through that in detail. Totally fake, totally phony. The woman who allegedly died, Heather Heyer, actually turns out to have died the following day of a heart attack. So they simply throw her into the mix, just as we had Ashley Babbitt allegedly shot in the Capitol when she didn't pose a serious threat to anyone, and where it looks very much as though that was another stage event that Ashley actually, I believe, is alive and well. I don't think she's in Tahiti sipping Mai Tais. Meanwhile, Elizabeth Holmes tweeted, "These men approached Glenn Youngkin's bus as it pulled up, saying what sounded like, 'We're all in for Glenn.' Here they are standing in front of the bus at his campaign event in Guadalajara started. Local and national media dutifully reported the group said what sounded like, 'We're all in for Glenn,' as they posed outside the bus. The report was then amplified by McAfee staffers. Christina Friedland said, This is who Glenn Youngkin's supporters are. While Jen Goodman called it disgusting and disqualifying, both tweets have since been deleted. When asked about it, Youngkin said, "I think they work for Terry McAuliffe, and I'm sure he sent them. Any of the Democrats will do anything to win." Well, he's absolutely spot on. McAuliffe's campaign, of course, immediately reacted, denying the claim. "This was not us or anyone affiliated with our campaign," they said, adding it was shameful and wrong to accuse them. But the internet sleuths went to work, alleging those were actually Democrat activists. Following the claim, the suspected activists began locking and purging their social media profiles one after another. According to one social media user, the fact the media themselves showed zero interest in identifying the so-called racist was suspicious on its own. But there was lots and lots blasted around. This gross false flag operation reeks of desperation from the McAuliffe camp, who's currently trailing Youngkin by 8, tweeted Alex Sears, a conservative political consultant. But get this. He proceeded to claim two people in the photos, a man and a woman, look like staffers with Virginia Democrats and Virginia non-Democrats. Both quickly scrubbed their social media accounts. So did a black Democrat activist who was accused of being part of the stunt. The presence of a black man amidst the alleged white supremacist quickly made Jussie Smollett and Clayton Bigsby trend on Twitter. The former's the actor awaiting trial for allegedly fabricating a hate crime against himself and blaming Republicans in Chicago. I've reported on it. The other's a black Klansman character created by David Chappelle. But get this. The fact that Clayton Bigsby and the rest of the Merrick Garland Craigslist actors brought tiki torches out in the pouring rain tells you everything you need to know. Plus, maybe it was a hat, sunglasses, uniform of white dress, shirt, and khakis, or maybe it's the black guy. Just incredible stuff. But he wasn't the only one recognizing people. This random Twitter user recognized the woman who was spotted driving Terry McAuliffe's van in the small, pathetic group of alleged neo-Nazis. How disgusting is this? So, the Lincoln Group stepped in here to take responsibility, take the heat off of Terry McAuliffe. But look, this is just absurd. The Democrats are so committed to diversity, even when they do a fake false flag about white supremacists, they have to put in a black man and a woman, which makes the whole thing completely absurd. And she even turns out to be one who drives Terry McAuliffe's van. Think about that. Ponder that. That's what we're up against. This is the kind of bullshit we get from the Democratic Party today. And tomorrow, we'll see what happens in Virginia. It would be a wipeout if the vote is on, and so all eyes will be on the state. We'll see what happens then. We're hitting up against a break, and I hope to be able to bring in my featured guest thereafter.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out "And Nobody Died in Boston Either." Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
That the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years.
to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener supported radio station on the planet, not giving up. Revolution Radio.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job? That Osama had nothing to do with it? That the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes? That Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building? Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons of the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to
Revolution Radio,
FreedomSlips.com, 100% listeners.
I thought I'd be able to hear by joining me.
Now we return you to your host.
Go, Jim.
Oh, very good. Very good. Very good, Mitchell. I still can't hear a bloody thing. What happened in... Yeah. What happened in Charlottesville was completely contrived. When it happened, I did a huge amount of research. I had a special interest in Charlottesville. I had taught there twice. When I was denied tenure at Kentucky as an assistant professor, even though I had published more articles and better journals than any candidate they had before, had better course evaluations, had received the first Distinguished Teaching Award presented by the student government to one out of 135 assistant professors, explicitly to encourage the faculty that the students believe this person was deserving his tenure, I had stepped on too many toes. I'd even given like 12 talks at 8 different departments, which is just unheard of, but it occurred because of my interdisciplinary background in the history and the philosophy of science. But I stepped on too many toes. I'd, you know, served in the Marine Corps. I'd wear my combat boots, you know, put them up on the table during faculty meetings. In retrospect, I guess I was pretty outrageous. I thought I was one of the faculty. There were 6 tenured faculty. And although I was, you know, reappointed and I've been getting these great course evaluations and all that, when it came up for tenure, they divided 3-3, which was enough to deny me tenure, where one of them, who had received his PhD at Harvard back in 1942 and was an elder in the Presbyterian Church, explained to a colleague who remained, you know, in the department after I'd left, that he'd voted against me because I live with my girlfriend without the benefit of marriage. I mean, this is a guy who wrote, what can we expect of the department in the future? I mean, this is ridiculous. Another was the head of the department who thought they ought to have a PhD program, and I thought that was a bad idea. We had a very successful master's program, so we'd take students who were weak in their background and beef them up, and they'd go off to graduate school to programs. Well, he was upset I wouldn't support. The guy had been hired under what I take to be fraudulent circumstances, presenting himself as having a PhD in the philosophy of religion, when in fact he had a PhD in religion. So, you know, he wasn't even a philosopher. And so he voted against me too. The third was a fellow who'd been responsible. Actually, his hometown was adjacent to mine. He was from Alhambra, California, whereas I had, you know, in junior high and high school, lived in South Pasadena, just across Huntington Drive. And he'd always got really mediocre course evaluations, which he explained away on the ground that logic was a difficult subject and the students didn't like it. Well, they gave those programs to me. And I had a group of graduate students who'd taken logic with me. And because I had my own difficulties with logic, with formal logic, this is called symbolic logic, when I was myself an undergraduate, it had taken me a good while to sort out what was going on and to appreciate that this was a model. This was an artificial model of language that resembled language in certain respects, but not in others. And that if you understood the features, that certain artificialities that were introduced in the artificial model, then you could make it much easier to understand. And so eventually, by virtue of having gone through this arduous experience myself, I was able to successfully convey to my graduate students what was really going on with logic. So we were turning out hundreds of little students of logic who were wildly enthusiastic, contributing to my being selected for the first Distinguished Teaching Award. And of course, the first recipient thereof to be denied a tenure. Well, the point I'm making is Virginia hired me as a visiting associate professor, thereby in effect giving me the promotion I'd been denied, though obviously only on a visiting appointment, where UVA was at the time the number one public university in the United States. So Kentucky was always a middling university, you know. I mean, I really didn't belong there because my scholarly abilities far exceeded those of the typical faculty member at Kentucky. But I had come at it a bad time because of my service in the Marine Corps. Jobs were abundant and plentiful then, but during those years I wasn't available. And by the time I got out and earned my PhD in 1970, the market had just completely transformed and jobs were very difficult. In any case, Virginia salvaged me, for which I shall always be grateful. And I wound up having a string of different appointments for the next 10 years, followed as Cincinnati, and then I got an NSF on which I wrote my first book, and then went to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Chapel Hill, a really wonderful school. Wound up down at New College at the University of South Florida on Sarasota Bay, a wonderful little school, only 400 students and 40 faculty. Everyone designs their own curriculum. Every student does an undergraduate thesis and all that. But I was replacing a fellow for 2 years who they expected would not return. But lo and behold, he returned. And I was given a visiting appointment there as a MacArthur, a visiting distinguished fellow. I was so insecure at the time, I had what I think was the longest title ever in academia, the John T. and Catherine T. MacArthur Visiting Distinguished Professor in the Arts and Sciences at New College at the University of South Florida. And I was so insecure at the time that when I would be sending out my applications, I'd write out that whole thing. John D. and Catherine, MacArthur, visiting distinguished professor in the arts and science. I mean, it was just crazy. In any case, Virginia brought me back as a visiting full professor. And this, then I went into a program in artificial intelligence, computer science, transformed my whole life professionally, because the year before, which would have been 1986, as I recall, December, though it might have been 85, I had had 7 interviews at the Eastern APA, all for junior positions. I went into this program for students who have backgrounds, PhDs in philosophy or in linguistics. And all of a sudden, there was great interest. I think it was because I was doing hands-on work in the field, and a lot of departments like that. So I had 7 interviews, all senior. And I was actually hired then as full professor with tenure on the Duluth campus of the University of Minnesota just a couple of months later, 1987, as I recall. And I had so much bundled up energy and creativity from all those 10 years and all that, that I began mass producing books. I mean, I had like 16 books published at University of Minnesota in the next few years, so that when the university instituted a new form of recognition for their most successful full professors who had enhanced the reputation of the University of Minnesota by their publications and research while they were at the University of Minnesota, I turned out to be a prime candidate and was among the very first 10 to become a distinguished McKnight University professor, a title I retain to this day with the addendum of emeritus, meaning retired but in good standing. So my technical title is McKnight Distinguished University Professor Emeritus. I mean, always a wonderful title. I thought it was the best title I ever heard. But I published all these books. So, you know, I'd get the research award in the college and all that sort of thing. But then I retired in 2006 after 35 years. And the courses in logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning I taught there were very popular courses. And then moved down here to Madison for family reasons and, you know, continued the research in conspiracies that had begun with JFK. Indeed, the University of Minnesota even funded 2 conferences I held on the assassination, one in 1999 in Minneapolis and the other in 2003 on the Duluth campus. The first brought in a wonderful assortment of speakers, and out of that I edited Murder in Dealey Plaza, published in 2000. My first was, of course, Assassination Science in 1998. Where I brought together the best medical experts to ever study the assassination. We discovered the autopsy x-rays had been altered by concealing a fist-sized blowout to the back of the head, that the brain shown in diagrams and photographs in the National Archives wasn't even the brain of JFK, that there was evidence of a second shot to the head. I mean, it was just sensational stuff, and I believe it was probably the single most important book from a scientific point of view in overthrowing, exposing the charade, because once you understand that the autopsy x-rays were edited, another brain was substituted, that the whole movies were massively edited, it was a book that went through 14 different printings, by far my most successful, because once you understand how they fabricated the evidence, and that's a crucial aspect, of course, of scientific reasoning, that you sort out the authentic from the fabricated, the fake, it becomes pretty easy to sort out what happened. I mean, the KGB, for example, could not have altered x-rays that were under control of medical officers of the U.S. Navy and the Secret Service. The anti-Castro Cubans couldn't have extended the reach into Bethesda Naval Hospital to substitute someone else's brain for the brain of John F. Kennedy. The mob couldn't have got its hands on the home movies like the Zapruder film to undertake massive editing when it was exclusively in the possession of the Secret Service after it had been obtained from Abraham Zapruder, who'd filmed it in Dealey Plaza. And of course, it turns out it was sent to a secret CIA lab in Rochester, New York, known as Hawkeye Works. It was extensively revised. In fact, the original would have had around 1,000 frames, but they took out 100 of the motorcade turning from Houston onto Elm because the driver, William Greer, mistook the frontage road right in front of the book depository for Elm Street and swung out too widely, had to pause and hesitate to get back in line, which the American people observing would have found unnerving that the Secret Service didn't know what it was doing. In fact, I discovered 14 indications of Secret Service complicity in setting the man up for the hit. So when Nigel Turner put together his seventh part of The Men Who Killed Kennedy, he featured me and the medical experts I'd brought together in an episode entitled The Smoking Guns about how it was carried out. And so there was another, the limousine was, Jack was hit twice, once in the throat from, well, first in the back from behind about 5.5 inches down below the collar, just to the right of the spinal column, by a shallow shot that only went in about as far as the second knuckle on your little finger. We got the jacket, we got the shirt that show it. David W. Manick, MD, PhD, with whom I've been collaborating since 1992, had members of the staff put it on so we could actually see and discern that the hole in the shirt was ever so slightly below the hole in the jacket, implying a downward trajectory. That was 5.5 inches below the collar. I did a whole presentation at Cambridge during an international conference on how, if you only know where JFK was hit in the back, you had sufficient grounds with a couple other obvious premises to establish it had been a conspiracy, which is published and available online under the title of Reasoning About Assassinations. So I encourage anyone who wants to understand the technique I pioneered of applying scientific reasoning and collaborative research to sort these things out. I think you'd find that to be a wonderful introduction to what I'm all about, Reasoning About Assassinations. It's available online. And then in, the second conference that was sponsored by the university was all in the Zapruder film, where I brought the 6 leading experts in the world. It was a tiny conference, meaning we had virtually no audience. But we had the wonderful panelists, including David Manning himself, Jack White, a leading expert on photographs and film, David Healy, who is knowledgeable about the technical status of optical printing and special effects at the time, John P. Costella, who would do another PhD in physics, who do a brilliant job of, of a tutorial showing evidence internal to the film itself that proves it was a fabrication, even though it's 98% technically flawless. Where you can find John's tutorial on my original website, assassinationscience.com, you scroll down and you'll find the John's tutorial, plus the best available frames of the Zapruder film we have, because he corrected for aspect ratio and another form of pincushion distortion. So you got the whole 487 frames there, and also you have a version of the film when it's centered on the automobile, which, by the way, I regard as an indication that the footage actually in Dealey Plaza, at least some of which was taken by a camera mounted on a tripod. Because if Zapruder had actually been filming it, he would have followed the car and you wouldn't have the car virtually disappear at the bottom of the frame. I mean, it's just fascinating how complicated this issue is. But the driver, William Greer, after Jack had been hit once in the back and then hit in the throat by a shot that passed through the windshield, creating a small, clean puncture wound, The driver, Greer, again, pulled the limousine to the left and to a halt to make sure Jack would be killed, and he was hit in the back of the head. Slumped forward, Jack eased him back up and was looking at him right in his face when he was hit in the right temple by a frangible or exploding bullet that blew out his